I'm Zach. I'm a musician, a former worship leader. I helped destroy Mars Hill Church. I'm not really sure what I believe anymore, and I am okay with that.
I'm Dave. I'm a Bible theology nerd, an occasional preacher, a movie buff, and I'm a committed Christian.
Who is not using the term evangelical as of officially last episode.
Two episodes ago.
Well, we made it official last episode. You tried sneaking it in 2 episodes ago. So now that this is Dave, committed Christian, no longer evangelical Dave. This is Veterans of Culture Wars.
Veterans of Culture Wars is a podcast where we have conversations about evangelical Christianity, welcoming you to the podcast, whether you are a believer or not. Please consider supporting our show at patreon.com/VCW pod. You can also rate and review our podcast wherever you like to get podcasts. And for this episode, we are excited for a return guest. Who is David Barton? Our guest is not David Barton. Don't worry about that if you know who he is. Why is it important for you to know who David Barton is? What does David Barton have to do with current movements of Christian nationalism? And what does all of this have to do with Thomas Jefferson, America's founding father? Well, our guest today has been on the VCW pod before, all the way back in episode 25, where we spoke about Mark Driscoll and his Trinity Church in Arizona. He was a professor of psychology at Grove City College for 29 years and is currently enjoying retirement. In August of 2019, he was a part of Netflix's 5-part series titled The Family, which is about the Fellowship Foundation. He is a prolific blogger. In 2012, he published a book titled Getting Jefferson Right, Fact-Checking Claims About Our Third President, which was triggered by the publishing of David Barton's book, The Jefferson Lies. A second edition has just come out of that book, Getting Jefferson Right, on November 1st of last year. And very recently, he has been busy at work producing a podcast called Telling Jefferson Lies, which is exposing mythology about America's founding father and third president. Welcome back to the show, former professor Warren Throckmorton.
Hey, thanks for having me.
So good to have you back. You shared your story about evangelical Christianity back in episode 25. I am now joining you with not using the label anymore, as Zach was alluding to in the open. But let's start here with this episode. Let's talk about who David Barton is, because there is probably some in our audience who have no idea who this is, who maybe have not heard this name before. So who is David Barton, and why is it important for people to know who David Barton is?
David Barton is probably the man most responsible for the current Republican Party's strong belief in America as a Christian nation. I know that sounds like a big statement, or, you know, that he's kind of responsible for something, and you may not have heard of the guy, but as we chronicle in the podcast, we go all the way back to the beginning of his career and look at the developments over, since about 1989, when he started out. He really is just, we call him Where's Waldo. Catherine Stewart is one of the guests in the podcast, and Catherine Stewart calls him the Where's Waldo of the Christian nationalist world. And it's true. He is in everything. He's in many of the movements to bring state laws in line with the, you know, Christianity, the Ten Commandments laws, the laws to have chaplains in place of school counselors. in various states. He travels the country trying to bring legislatures in line with Christian nationalist aims, and he really just seems tireless. I have to give him that. He's got way more energy than I've got. He's everywhere, and he is in his influence the current Speaker of the House, but that's not the first Speaker of the House that he's influenced. When Newt Gingrich was considering a run for president, he told David Barton that if he did that, he was going to call on Barton for help and advice. Paul Ryan thought he was a pretty good guy. A lot of Republican politicians do. He ran a super PAC for Ted Cruz for a while and was I was never Cruz before I was never Trump, but Barton was on the stump with Cruz, when he was back before he was out of the running, in 2016. So Barton is he claims to be a historian, but he's really not. And we go through that. We go through how he has created a brand to influence politics using history, not being a historian, but using history to create a brand and influence Republican policy.
And who is Thomas Jefferson? I joke, but
Oh, I doggone it. You stumped me.
yeah, I don't know if there's a lot of history buffs listening right now, but
I didn't know there were
this
going to
one.
be such hard questions on this podcast.
But
I would
I guess
never have come on.
there kind of is a question in there though. Like, well, I guess one, like I always kind of wondered if you were particularly interested in Thomas Jefferson before the Barton book, or if it was more just awareness of the problems you were seeing with Barton that made you dig further into Thomas Jefferson. But who is Thomas Jefferson to David Barton versus the real Thomas Jefferson?
Well, let's see how to go about that. I'll tackle the surface part of that, and then we can go whatever other direction you'd like to go.
Sure.
I think that for Jefferson, he's important to Christian nationalists like David Barton because he's the wall of separation guy. He's the fellow who wrote that, not wrote it, but well, wrote it. Yeah, wrote it in a letter to the Danbury Baptists, talking about that the First Amendment created a wall of separation between church and state. And that phrase has come up in quite a few court cases over the years that have had some real consequence. And because of the wall of separation being a pretty clear image that church and state are separate, and it stands for the idea of separation of church and state, that people who would like to cozy up the relationship between church and state, Jefferson presents a bit of a problem for them. And so reinterpreting Jefferson as not really all that concerned with the church and state being separate, that's a pretty important task for them. And that's what the Jefferson Lies tried to do. And I think that's why Barton was kind of preoccupied with him back in 2012.
So it's sort of like they're realizing that Jefferson presents the greatest weakness to their arguments, and so the project that he's engaged in is figuring out how to turn their biggest weakness into one of their biggest strengths, and saying that no, actually Jefferson is this huge proponent of everything that we believe in.
Well, at least he's not a tremendous obstacle. And I think that, there are some things about Jefferson that are a little surprising. I think a lot of people are surprised that in the early days of Washington, D.C., the chaplains led church services in the Capitol. There weren't many churches in Washington, D.C., and chaplains had the idea to use the house facilities to have Sunday services. And now, Jefferson attended some of those services, Jefferson wasn't Orthodox Christian, but he did believe in God and thought that there was an afterlife that you'd be judged in for your good works or
Interesting.
lack thereof. He wasn't, even though he was, you know, by upbringing an Anglican, he didn't have an Orthodox belief system. But he did go to church, and did attend some of those services. But Barton goes further. See, Barton makes up a claim that Jefferson started church in the Capitol, that he authorized it and had something to do with it. Well, he didn't go out of his way to stop it or anything, and he did attend some of the services. But Barton tries to go further than that. And that's what the Jefferson Lies book does a lot of. Takes some events and makes them weapons in a culture war today. You know, we don't really get it. The past is a foreign country. You know, to Jefferson, that may not have seemed like a breach of church and state to do that to him. I think to us today, it might. But to him, it didn't. But he certainly didn't start church in the Capitol.
Yeah.
And for Barton to make up these stories, it's an effort to take Jefferson out of the way as an obstacle to cozying up church and state together now.
Yeah, tying together a couple of threads there. So the Danbury Baptist letter that Jefferson sent, that was sent in 1802. And so I can imagine David Barton and many conservatives, and actually I heard this back in my conservative days, where you would hear people who are on the religious right say, there is no phrase wall of separation between church and state in the Constitution. But what's important to note is Jefferson, who wrote the First Amendment in 1802, he wrote this letter to the Danbury Baptists. So it's very clear that Jefferson himself interpreted the First Amendment of the Constitution that way. At least that's how I see it.
He referred to the First Amendment in the response to the Danbury Baptist, and then said that you know, that created a wall of separation. And so, no, it's not in the Constitution, but there are a lot of things that aren't in the Constitution that are implied by it.
Yeah, it's pretty bare bones. Yeah,
you know, and Jefferson basically interpreted the First Amendment in that way, and that's why that letter is referred to.
And in the podcast, you go over one of Barton's major claims is that wall of separation is a one-directional wall. Can you explain what he means by that?
Right. One-directional wall, meaning that the government can't influence the church. And that's what Jefferson meant. That's what Barton says Jefferson meant, was that separation of church and state, or the wall of separation, was an oddly phrased one directional wall, so that the government can't tell the church what to do, but the separation doesn't go the other direction. Church and Christianity can influence government. You can have statements of faith, and government leaders can pray and do all kinds of Christian things. And that doesn't violate that wall of separation.
And going back, kind of circling back around to Thomas Jefferson's religious beliefs, which obviously are greatly exaggerated or just lied about by David Barton. Yeah, it's interesting to think in this term of Thomas Jefferson being a politician and in communicating or putting out an image of himself because he's representing or serving people, like all politicians do. I don't necessarily think it means that Jefferson was insincere, but it's more like, you know, when you're a politician, you symbolically do things to get elected or to get people to like you. I read a book a while ago. I don't know if you've read this one, Warren, showing this in the chat. This is Thomas Jefferson, Author of America by Christopher Hitchens, who is famously the New Atheist. And Hitchens had a take on Thomas Jefferson in this book, obviously saying he was a deist. He didn't believe God was involved in the world, or he believed in a God that was impersonal in some way. His Jefferson's famous Bible on display in the Smithsonian, if I'm remembering correctly, is called The Life and Morals of Jesus of Nazareth. And it's where he razor bladed out all the miracles, including the resurrection, and also any passages that talked about Jesus being divine. And this was kind of Jefferson's Bible. And so Hitchens talks a lot about that, him being a deist. And Hitch's take on it was that if somebody was going to be a non-believer in that day, they could not be an intellectually fulfilled atheist until 1859, when Charles Darwin wrote On the Origin of the Species. And so, in other words, Hitch was making Jefferson kind of like himself, like in his camp, saying, oh, you know, if Jefferson read On the Origin of the Species, maybe he wouldn't believe in God at all. Do you think that's a fair representation of what Jefferson believed himself, his religious and philosophical views, or is, I don't know, what do you think about that?
I wouldn't characterize it quite that way. There's some parts of that that sound right, and there are other parts that don't sound quite right in accord with my reading of him. In a way, Jefferson's views are not that hard to discern. He wrote a syllabus at one point. He called it a syllabus. It's not like the syllabus that, you know, I used to give out to students, but it was a synopsis of his religious beliefs, and he gave it to some of his family. He gave it to some of the close confidants in government there that he had in his cabinet. He gave it to Benjamin Rush, who was kind of surprised by it. His response was, "Well, at least you're not an atheist," was Rush's response to it. But boy, this is different than it's certainly not orthodox. Jefferson liked Joseph Priestley. Joseph Priestley was a Unitarian, but he, you know, who didn't believe in Jesus' divinity, didn't believe in, you know, the resurrection and virgin birth and various things. He had some other heroes. Conyers Middleton was one, and these were all skeptics. But he did believe in an afterlife. He believed in, he said that my religion requires good works. And he thought he would be judged based on those. So he did leave in the Jefferson Bible. There were two extractions of the Jefferson Bible, one in 1804 and one somewhere around 1820. We don't know for sure when it was done. But he did leave in Jesus' words about judgment, the final judgment. A lot of people in that day believed that there needed to be, that the religion of the day, whatever religion you believed in, there had to be some kind of final judgment. How else would you be moral if you weren't worried that God was going to judge you someday? And so whether you were Orthodox or not, there seemed to be a pretty common theme there. But the idea that the Jefferson didn't think that God would intervene, I don't know that that's quite true. And he did seem to believe in this, you know, idea of an afterlife. But when it came to the orthodoxy concerning Jesus and the gospel, and he thought Calvinists were atheists. He didn't like Calvinism a bit. Has that, you know, in common a little bit with the new Mark Driscoll, who now thinks, you know, Calvinism is awful after, you know, and now that he doesn't, you know, he used to think it was great. But, he thought it was awful. Yeah, Jefferson did. And so he certainly wasn't Orthodox, but he when it came to the divinity of Christ, the virgin birth, and all those kinds of things, he thought that was silly. But he did have a kind of respect for the teachings, the moral teachings of Christ. And that's what he did with the Jefferson Bible, with that abridgment. He cut out what he thought was evidently the reformer of the Jewish faith, Jesus, the man. He thought those were great moral teachings, cut those out and left everything else in there that he thought was added by his disciples.
Yeah, I know you. The podcast talks about the so-called Jefferson Bible quite a bit, and what Barton's take is on it, where he says that essentially Jefferson was endeavoring to reduce it to just the red letter text, just the words of Jesus, so that it could be
right.
used as an easy to digest proselytization tool for converting Native Americans. Now, I don't know many methods of sharing the gospel with people that would cut out, for example, John 3:16, or I am the way, the truth, and the life. Nobody comes to the Father except through me. That also removed. Like, this is not just the red letters, just Jesus, what Jesus said. It's the stuff that he liked. And apparently it pretty much ends with, and the stone was rolled up against the tomb, the end. Like, no resurrection, no great commission.
Nope.
So
none of that.
Yeah. how do we know that Barton's take on the Jefferson Bible is a bunch of hooey?
Well, Jefferson created a table of texts, you know, like a table of contents, but a listing of texts that he intended to use. And then there are two Bibles that he ordered that were delivered to the White House. And he said in letters to friends that they took a couple of nights. Can you imagine this guy? You know, he's president of the United States. And he's got two Bibles, and he's sitting there with a razor at night cutting out Bible verses. Can you imagine if Obama had done that?
I think, yeah, it just sounds like he was procrastinating. Like, clearly there's some presidential decision that he doesn't want to have to make.
Well, you know, I do think things were less complicated then.
Probably,
you know, things must have been. But anyway, so he's sitting there with his Bibles, and he's got this table of text, and he goes and finds one, you know, okay, next. And he goes to find it, and he cuts it out, and he's pasting it in this other book that he, you know, created just for this purpose. And then apparently there were some verses that he stumbled onto, just a handful, that he cut out that weren't in the table. And we know that because the Bibles that he used survived. We still have those. They're at the University of Virginia. The actual 1804 version was lost somehow. There is no copy of that. So it's kind of a mystery, you know, what he actually ended up with. He could have cut out some of those verses and not included them. He might have just said, well, oops, you know, I cut this out and I'm not going to use it. We don't really know. But anyway, so some of those, there were four of them that Dickinson Adams, the first guy that ever tried to recreate this, decided these just don't sound like Jefferson. I'm not going to put them in. Well, Barton jumps on that and says, well, you're just being ideological about it. And as it turns out, a couple of them did have some miraculous content to it. Okay, well, put them in if you want. But, you know, there's a whole bunch of others, like the ones we just talked about, John 3:16 and 14, John 14, I'm the way, the truth, the life, and the resurrection. Those are not in there. Those verses are still in those Bibles. He didn't cut them out. So, you know, Barton's contention is just silly. The other reason that Barton includes some of those verses is because he relied on a book. I didn't go into this in the podcast. This is just free for your listeners.
Exclusive.
It's an exclusive. Well, if they get my book, I'm giving away book content now. So what Barton did was he relied on a book by a guy named Charles Sanford called The Religious Life of Thomas Jefferson. And in that book, Sanford just borrowed the tables of text from another author. He didn't do a reconstruction. He just listed the tables of text from another biography by a guy named Henry Randall. So he just put them in the appendix, but he made a copying error. And he put a bunch of verses from Matthew 9 in there that actually weren't in the original book that Sanford used. Well, Barton seized on that and said, well, Sanford said they were in there. Well, Sanford made a mistake. And Barton will not acknowledge that. You know, and Barton's the one that says that all these historians don't use primary sources. And Barton's using something that's like third hand, and
Right.
it's wrong. You know, it's a mistake, and it's easily proven. But he,
Yeah,
man, he just presses ahead.
you have another story on the podcast that becomes like a fourth hand thing where somebody like years later is it says, I remember having a conversation with Jefferson, or somebody told me that they had a conversation with Jefferson on the way to church where he's like, this is a Christian nation, you know. And this is conveyed, you know, after he's dead, and somebody else hears it and tells somebody else, and then Barton's like, okay, well, that's evidence that Jefferson said it, even though there is no primary source going on here. So by the time it gets to Barton's book, it's a fourth, four generations or whatever that term is. But yeah, it's wild.
Yep.
And he has a way of kind of lumping things together and confusingly referring to stuff to obscure that he's doing that. I mean, you mentioned things like he'll say that the courts have said this or that, and that could be any court. It could be some city court or the Supreme Court, whatever, but it sounds official. Or he'll say the founding
Traffic
fathers
court.
And it means to him essentially anybody who was living at the time of the founding of the country, whether they had anything to do with constructing our government or not. There is an incredible story on the podcast about John Locke and specifically how Barton came up with a certain large number he claimed was the amount of times that Locke quoted the Bible.
This is incredible.
And I think this is a great distillation, great illustration of the ways he lies to his audience. Can you tell that story and explain how he confuses people like this, how he misleads people using this tactic?
Well, for reasons that you know, are known mostly to Barton, he likes to talk about John Locke. Well, John Locke was a pretty influential, even though he wasn't widely read. In the founding era, a lot of people think he was, but Locke scholars have, you know, decide. I'm not a Locke scholar, but they've decided he was influential on a few of the founding fathers, and that was all that was necessary. Anyway, Barton likes to say that John Locke quoted the Bible 1,500. Now let's see, 15. Here's the first claim: 1,500 Bible verses in the two treaties of government. This is John Locke's, you know, big important. Books on government. 1,500 Bible verses. That's a lot of Bible verses. These aren't big books. All right. So my friend Greg Forster, who's a Locke scholar, he actually counts up the Bible verses. And there's, I don't know, something like 600 or something like that. If you take all the chapters that he refers to, you might say like Matthew chapter 15. He didn't refer to any particular verse. He just says Matthew 15. So, okay, we add up all the verses in there, about 600. And so we're trying to figure out, all right, how do we get to 1,500? So I notice that he referred to the book of Proverbs in the two treatises. And I'm thinking, no, is there 900 verses in the book of Proverbs? So I count them. There are 900 verses in the book of Proverbs. So that's how he gets to 1,500 verses. It's the only possible way.
It's so unreal.
He says that John Locke quotes the Bible. Wait, now I got to get this right. Quotes 1,500 Bible verses. And the way he gets there is by since John Locke just said the book of Proverbs. So he just lumps all 900 in there. But then in the second edition of Jefferson Lies, I hadn't really noticed this shift. Greg Forster told me about it. He said that now Barton says he quotes the Bible 1,500 times. So that would be separate times.
I mean, that's like,
so
it's like saying that I had 30 sandwiches for lunch yesterday because I went to Subway and they have 30 sandwiches on their menu. it's insane.
Yeah.
Now that we've, I think we've given listeners an idea of some of the just wild stuff that David Barton claims historically, specifically about Thomas Jefferson, I think it's maybe now time to just ask the question, how is David Barton, again, so popular? Like, how did this process work? Because you mentioned earlier, Professor Throckmorton, that Paul Ryan, who was a vice presidential candidate to Mitt Romney in 2012 and then was Speaker of the House for a little bit during the first part of the Trump term. And you also talked about Newt Gingrich, who has a long history in conservative Republican politics. 1994, the Gingrich Revolution, where Republicans won Congress back for the first time in a long time. These are major, no matter what we think of them, and I'm not a huge fan personally. I don't know if any of us are. They are major American figures at this point. And they're both referencing that David Barton is a good guy or something of that nature. How did he become so popular with these groups?
I'm going to do what a lot of people do in my situation, refer to our products, and I will get specific, but this is where I think the podcast does something that the book doesn't even do. We have some guests that really do a great job, Catherine Stewart and Randall Stevens, particularly in the Where's Waldo
on the
second
show.
Episode.
She's amazing.
Yeah. They go into, and Julie Ingersoll, I got to, get
Ingersoll.
Julie Ingersoll
yeah.
in there too.
Yeah.
You know, they talk about the way that David Barton has created a brand using history. I say on the podcast that he's not an expert in history, but he's an expert in using history to create a brand. And the brand is, I'm a trusted source for historical facts. And, one of the things that is a part of that brand is ideological similarity. People who are consuming the information, they look at him and he's so devout. He uses all the right Christian language. And they just can't believe that somebody who is that Christian can lie to them, can look at them and lie to them to their face. Because that's what he does in his presentations. He's right in front of them. He's in a church. They've just prayed, maybe had a worship service. And he gets up and says all this stuff. Some of it's true. And that's the thing, some of it is true. But these massively off stories are, of course, aren't true. And he delivers it with the same delivery. He talks confidently. He talks rapidly. And, I'm a psychologist by training. And, we teach in social psychology that if you deliver something confidently and quickly, and if you there's a certain way you can deliver information so that people will trust what you're saying. And he has that down. And this,
I know,
like
political interviews, they call it the Gish Gallop. If you just quickly recite enough information that it doesn't leave a gap for people to knock down anything, they can't keep up with the amount of lies that you spew.
Yeah. Another phenomenon I think applies here, and it's called the awestruck effect. And the awestruck effect, this has been, studied quite a bit by organizational psychologists, where once a person has, once the speaker has a kind of a crowd in his or her grasp, the crowd tends to turn off their cognitive processing, that the rapidity of the speakers, giving out all this information, you can't keep up. It's very hard to keep up with it. And so the ability to cognitively process kind of, is shut down for one. You just start taking in the information. And as Randall Stevens said in one of the podcast episodes, it becomes a feeling thing. It just feels right. It feels true. And once you get somebody feeling like you've got the truth and they're trusting you that you have the truth, then you're a Christian and you wouldn't lie to them. And they put their trust in you, then it's awfully hard to shake that. Especially when he does a pretty good job of casting you, meaning me, as a leftist or, you know, liberal or godless pagan or something like that. You know, then it gives the listener, a person who holds on to the information that he's given them, a reason to doubt the critic. And I've seen this over and over again, that, you know, they put the critic in the camp of the bad guy,
mm-hmm.
of the anti-Christian. I mean, almost everybody you know, I talk to, they don't know me, or they'll just contact me and say, why are you, you know, going after David Barton, assumes I'm not a Christian.
Right.
I teach at Grove. Yeah. I taught at Grove City College. I mean, there are a lot of indications of my Christian affiliations. And yet, because I oppose David Barton, I all of a sudden leave that camp.
Yeah. You're very open about, sorry.
Yeah. Well, that's right.
You're very open about your Christian faith. And I think it's the value of, you want to make sure that facts and truth are spoken, which sort of is a value that all of us should be on board with, right?
Yeah, we talked about that the last time that you were on, sort of the through line in a lot of your work is trying to help evangelicals figure out, do they care about truth in history? Do they care about truth in the books and such put out by famous pastors, that when they're saying that they're writing something, they're actually writing something? Is this really something that matters to a group of people that say they have cornered the market on truth, that they have, through God, a clear understanding of truth? How does that actually practically play out? Does it really actually matter when it comes down to it?
I have a side note here, which is completely unrelated. But when you mentioned the Gish Gallup, something triggered in my brain, and I just Googled it here. And that phrase is literally about Dwayne Gish, who, I don't know if either of you know this.
Huh.
Dwayne Gish, yeah, was,
I knew it was
a,
the last name of somebody, but
was a young earth creationist with the Institute of Creation Research. And this is just on Wikipedia. So I'm assuming this is probably accurate, but who knows? But I guess the term was coined by anthropologist Eugenie Scott, who named it after American creationist Dwayne Gish. And I do remember that Gish, in fact, had the style of debate where he would debate scientists, and I think scientists just stopped debating him after a while, but he would just bring up the, okay, second law of thermodynamics, amount of moon dust on the moon, shark fossils on a mountain range, and bring up all these things where scientists would be like, you're wrong, but listen, I need like 15 minutes to explain each of those things, because obviously the American public and science education may not be where we want it to be, and it, you know, you just have to unpack some of the nuances and complexity. So anyway,
and he's already moved on to five more things to that,
exactly.
Because it's performative expertise. And that's
exactly
what Barton's doing here. He is playing the part of historian. He is being an entertainer. He is a performer here, which you know, it gets us into our mutual friend Greg Thornberry's favorite word, kayfabe, and whether or not what David Barton is doing is engaging in kayfabe knowingly. You talk a little bit, and you've intimated here what you think, but could you say, do you think that generally speaking on most of what he is doing that you've figured out is not true? Do you think that he knows that he is lying? Do you think that he believes any of this stuff truly?
Well, okay. He has to know some of it's not true. And I say that because he said, for instance, about Coulter and I, that we were recruited by secular guys to bash his book, you know, to write our book. Well, that's crazy. We were not recruited by anybody. I recruited Coulter, but, you know, I guess maybe I am a secular guy in his mind, but nobody recruited me. And I know that. And so I know he knows that. And so, and as we, you know, pointed out in that long episode on the cataclysm, you know, when his book was pulled, He knew all the behind the scenes stuff that was going on. He knew that from the beginning because Jay Richards had told him what was going on, and they confronted him early on. And so he knew that secular guys didn't recruit us. And he knew we didn't recruit Jay Richards. So, yes, he definitely knows some things he says in public are not true. Is it true of all that historical thing, all the historical things that he says? I don't know. I really can't tell. He is really good at making you think he's sincere.
Yeah.
And I am, you know, my temperament is I'm skeptical of everybody. But I, you know, I'm a human being. I can be persuaded too by a clever story and a good delivery. So sometimes I just wonder how somebody can look right in the camera and say a known bold-faced lie. I can't do that. If I look in the camera and say something wrong, it's because I'm just mistaken.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Well, I think everybody else is like that.
And I think that's such a give. Like you mentioned Jay Richards, like, you know, Barton's trying to associate these names with, you know, some kind of nefarious left-wing plot or elitist. I mean, Jay Richards is, as you mentioned in the episode, is a fellow, I think that's the right term, at the Discovery Institute, a conservative think tank here in Seattle. And he's also with the Heritage Foundation. And I believe with the Heritage Foundation, he's in like the Betsy DeVos Center. So the billionaire Betsy DeVos, who donates to the Heritage Foundation. And Jay Richards puts out gender study stuff, like conservative talking points for gender theory and all that. This is not a progressive or even a moderate by any stretch of the imagination. I mean,
can you see me recruiting him to do anything?
Yeah, it's just, it's ridiculous.
Laughable.
Yeah. It's just crazy. I got one more here on Barton, and then I think we'll go a different direction unless Zach has some more questions.
Yeah, I think that's when we'll do our ad break.
We have an ad break we've rarely, if ever, done this in our podcast history. But I just want to ask about his ties to Christian nationalism. Christian nationalists are obviously very, very interested in David Barton's pseudo-historical, and that actually may be a generous term, his pseudo-historical claims. You talk about in your podcast how he has been a frequent guest on the Glenn Beck Show. That's probably another reason why he's so popular. I imagine he has made many rounds with different conservative media figures and many well-known right-wing commentators, which explains why a lot of the general public may not know who he is, but in conservative circles, he's very, very famous. So here's my question. Why do Christian nationalists think they have to redefine, or in many of their minds, uncover the real truth hidden by elite academics about American history? I have heard Christian nationalists talk about Jesus's Great Commission as being that they have to take dominion in a country and make the country Christian through politics and through government. But I mean, they could just tell the truth about America's founding and then just say, well, hey, we're going to make this country Christian through dominion and all that based on our really bad interpretation of the Great Commission. Why do they care so much about this phony history?
Well, the proper history makes the United States a plural, you know, religiously plural country where all religions are on an equal footing. I think that privileging Christianity, I think they feel that it gives them an advantage in their quest. Which really does run counter to, you know, what many of the founders believed, Madison in particular. I'm paraphrasing, but it's something to the effect of, well, you know, if Christianity needs the help of government, is it really a viable religion? But at any rate, I feel like that the Christian nationalist position is. And there are different strains of this. Some believe that it's a religious imperative. They believe that they've been challenged or instructed by God to take control of everything, take dominion, as you said, of everything, and that includes the government. And so for them, it's a religious imperative that they need to do, or else God will not bless the nation. And so if we are suffering of any kind of problems in the nation, the reason is that Christians aren't doing what they're supposed to do. Christian nationalists, they just see it as more of what is the best type of morality? What is the best way to go? What should laws reflect? Because they feel that laws are going to reflect some kind of ideology. It should reflect Christian ideology. And so they want to advocate for that. And why should it be Christian ideology? Well, after all, we were founded as a Christian nation. And so these stories that, David Barton and other Christian nationalist storytellers put forward support that perspective. Look, we were founded as a Christian nation. If it was good enough then, it's good enough now. We need to get back to our roots. Now, people of color and minorities certainly hear that differently than, the majority population does. Anyway, that's, I think that could be unpacked even further. And there are different kinds of Christian nationalists. So it depends on which kind you're talking about. David Barton kind or Stephen Wolfe kind. I mean, they're just, different kinds that, the Reconstructionist, Rufus J. Rushtuni, that's a whole different conversation. But I think in general, the Christian Nationalist Project is to find a usable past, to find a past that is supportive to what they would like to enact and bring to pass today.
Yeah, there's a lot of different camps that are under the umbrella of the White Christian Nationalist Project. You got the Rushtuni Dominionists, you got the NAR folks that think that by taking over the mountains that will cause Christ to return. And I think that right. Barton's role in all this is providing the pretext for the work that they are doing that's ultimately about power. I think the quest for power is the uniting principle behind all of those different camps that they're able to agree on. And that's what Catherine Stewart's amazing book is about. And so he is telling them that all this work that you're doing is to try to get, it isn't just theologically motivated. Yes, you have theological motivations. Yes, you think God wants Christians to take dominion, but what you are doing would be returning America to its original state, making it great again, undoing the work of the godless liberals who got the country off track from God's will and the founders' design for the country. As we said, we have an ad break. We have a new sponsor on the show, the Apple Vision Pro. This is Apple's new VR headset, and this exciting new podcast monetization opportunity is actually so new. This deal is so recent that we haven't received our new review devices yet, so we can't give our own take on this groundbreaking technology. But we are able to share with you this review from frequent VCW discussion topic and current pastor of the Trinity Church in Scottsdale, Arizona, Mark Driscoll. I will note that this is a video. He is apparently playing VR chess while doing this review. So that is the context of his thoughts here. Take it away, Mark.
Artificial intelligence, I would be weaponized by the demonic to create lies and parallel realities, and we can get into this maybe a little bit more later. But now you could bring up ancient political leaders, ancient spiritual religious leaders. You're going to see the rise in neo-paganism, and you're going to see occult activity, and you're going to see new hybrid religions emerge, and you're going to see artificial intelligence weaponized by the demonic to create a global deception. And I think this is actually a massive next step into the Antichrist and into the second coming of Jesus Christ before humanity ends itself. So to me, if I'm honest, first time I've worn these, and this is just kind of my initial reaction and response, I'm devastated and I feel like crying.
So the Apple Vision Pro, available now. I think what that clip speaks to for me is something we've talked about is Mark's chameleonic personality, where he senses the trend and where the money, where the power is, and wants to get involved with that camp. He's made inroads with New Apostolic Reformation folks. This sounds nothing like the Mark at Mars Hill. Like, even mentioning the rapture, I think he straight up said he didn't believe in a rapture.
Yeah, he used to make fun of it. He used to make fun of the people with the charts and the graphs, and
talking about the Antichrist. I mean, when we went through Revelation, he would point it out, framing the whole thing. This isn't about revealing the end of the world. It's about revealing Christ. That is what Revelation refers to in this. And he would frame everything by that. And now he's like, let's get into crazy eschatology and what this new technology means for the end of the world. It's just sad. And like Barton, we're talking about kayfabe. We're talking about somebody who is performing and the role of, he is being an entertainer. He is performing pastor. I'm wondering a couple things. Obviously, as I just said, like, Mark is very different in how he's presenting his theology and his persona these days. I'm wondering if you're seeing strong connections with white Christian nationalist movements, and specifically if there's any connection you know of between him and Barton these days.
I don't know of any direct connection between Driscoll and Barton. The Christian nationalist side of things, he, I think, prayed over Carrie Lake there in Arizona. And, you know, I think that that's a pretty popular group to hang with out there. I just see him as really seeking the notoriety that he had before. He seems to like that commercial you just played, or the or the clip you just played. I, you know, he had me at neo-pagan, man. Let's go. Because you know, we pagan professors, we have to have some tools, and so maybe I'll, you know, we just get those for our class. But, you know, it study history, too. He said you can bring back ancient political leaders. So maybe we just bring back Jefferson and ask him some questions.
Oh, there we go.
We'll settle these things once and for all. Right now, David Barton, let's put the headset on. Let's go.
Maybe that's what Apple Vision Pro is going to do for us. I like that.
Yeah. But I think he just wants to be desperately wants to be in the spotlight. And if he can just get a rumble going, get another tussle with the culture going, then maybe he'll be relevant again. And that's what it looks like to me. I've really toyed with what to do. Should I write about some of this stuff? And I think, no, daggone it. I think I'd be giving him what he wants.
Yeah. Yeah. I think these days that probably is right. I mean, the desperation feels pretty palpable when I saw he was hyping up, it's probably already happened by now, but an upcoming sermon series, calling it his most controversial or something like that, sermon series ever. And I'm like, okay, clearly he wants people to freak out at what he's saying and get those hate clicks and then monetize off of the hate. And
I saw that same thing. I think it was sometime last year, and that's when he launched into, oh, was it a First or Second King series? And he was talking about how eunuchs of that day are the transgender people of our day. And his exegesis is so awful, because the Bible actually, you know, the words of Jesus, what is it, Matthew, Acts 8, is incredibly welcoming and inclusive to eunuchs. As our friends Shannon Kearns and Billy Horta pointed out to us, they're right. He's just doing stuff like that. And he's trying to put right-wing populism onto the Bible, and it doesn't even really work if you just take the passage and actually read it that he's talking about. It's just complete nonsense.
Yeah, I don't see the I don't see the substance there. That, I mean, even in the old days when he was had the notoriety, you know, there was some substance. I listened to enough Driscoll sermons Before I started covering Mars Hill, I'd never heard one. And then when I started covering Mars Hill, I heard a lot of Driscoll sermons, and I thought the guy was funny. I thought he actually was, I kind of enjoyed listening to some of the sermons. That's actually news too, because I've never admitted that. But the new stuff is just, it just seems like a lot of grievance and a lot of anger.
Yep.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree. And I mean, that'll attract some amount of people, but not in the way that it was before, when he was known for being funny and edgy and also a little intellectual. That brought a lot more people. You know, that's the David Barton thing. You know, doesn't have to be telling the truth, but he is charismatic and knows how to work the crowd. And Driscoll was good at that in the same sort of way.
Yeah.
Well, Warren, thank you so much for your work, for coming back on the show. I guess we didn't scare you away the first time. I'm really enjoying the podcast. Do you know how many episodes it's going to be yet?
I don't. I'm thinking 8 or 10.
Okay.
Nice.
Yeah. We'll see where it goes. I have a few more interviews yet to do. And I don't know if it might be good to mention some of the people who haven't been on yet.
Oh, sure. That's a good tease.
And I'm really, really excited about this. I have interviewed Mark Knoll and George Marsden.
Oh, wow.
I don't know if you guys know those names, but they're...
Yes, both.
I know the first.
God likes to... They have a very special status among historians, and very thrilled to interview with them. They wrote a book back in 1983 called The Search for Christian America. And so they had actually debunked Barton before there was a Barton.
Oh, okay.
And their book is like a prophecy. It's crazy how you could read their book and think it was written yesterday. And so I've interviewed them, and I'm going to read quotes in the book. So right now I plan a segment just called "Are We Still Searching for Christian America?" Something like that, and have them featured. I have Paul Matsko, who's at the Cato Institute, Joel McDermott, who is kind of a recovering Reconstructionist, brilliant, brilliant guy. And then Anna Burks from Monticello is going to be on. And then Jamar Tisby. And you guys have probably heard of Jamar.
Oh, sure.
Yeah.
He's just a brilliant guy. And so anyway, and there may be some others that are coming up too. I'm trying to get some other folks to agree to come on. But I just feel so blessed to have so many great people who've agreed to come on and be a part of this. So it's been wonderful.
That's fantastic.
Yep. That podcast is Telling Jefferson Lies. There's 4 episodes so far, so our listeners can go listen to those and know that there are more coming with some impressive guests. Like that's a great roster that Professor Throckmorton had there. And also, remember, you can pick up a copy of the second edition of his book, Getting Jefferson Right, Fact-Checking Claims About Thomas Jefferson. That just came out last November. So in a second edition with updated information with Michael Coulter as his co-author. So, Professor Throckmorton, anything else you want to let everybody know about or where they can find you on the internet?
GettingJeffersonRight.com. is kind of the hub for all of this.
Fantastic. Right. Great to see Sounds you again.
Good. Yeah, you too. Thanks, guys.
And I'm glad you're enjoying your retirement by finding more work to do.
Well, I am actually way busier now than I was. Sometimes I yearn for the days just putting my feet up in my office, because been pretty busy with this. Editing I'm doing some of the music too this podcast.
I noticed that
the music is
also had
fun.
At least the first episode you had some music from our previously mentioned musical friend Greg Thornberry. author of Why Should the Devil Have All the Good Music, the Larry Norman biography. It's great to hear him on there. And I'm sure that doing this, even though you're busier than you were when you were teaching, as you say, I'm sure it's pretty rewarding stuff. More so when more people listen. So if you're listening to this, if you got this far, then either you're already listening to his show or you really should be listening to his show. So
that's
please
right.
Do that, everybody. Check it out. Thank you so much, Warren.
All right.
Well, Committed Christian Dave.
Hey, that's me. I'm kind of wishing I was retired so I can fill my days with like reading books and learning more stuff about Thomas Jefferson and, you know, actual true information about Thomas
Jefferson.
Are you
saying we should think about retiring to make a podcast?
Not necessarily. I like the people we talk to. I like these conversations.
I guess it'd be retiring to just do this.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Well, we need a few more Patreons, hint, hint, for everybody out there.
And yeah, I think our sponsorship with Apple for the Vision Pro, that was a one episode only deal. For legal purposes, there is no actual sponsorship with the Apple Corporation or the Vision Pro product.
Please don't sue us. We don't have any money.
So we're probably not ready to retire and do VCW full time.
That would be a lot of
still
fun.
Need those renovations. The roof is still needing some work. We need those tithes coming in. we're gonna do an entire month of episodes going through Nehemiah. So we can talk about the importance of building things and construction and how expensive that can be. And boy, it would be nice to have money sent in to do all those things.
Maybe we should start a second podcast. Ooh. And make it like ironic where we're right-wing populists and ask for money and
maybe the...
do a comparison of how much more money we can make, like just being super angry and paranoid and thinking, you know, that people are coming to get you.
Every episode of the VCW from now on is going to be the most controversial episode we've ever released. In a world where podcasts are driven by true crime, two podcasters are determined to not do true crime, but still be really scary.
It's going to be the most shocking thing you've ever heard.
Yeah.
I should probably take us out at that note.
Yeah.
All right.
Go for it.
Well, this has been another episode of Veterans of Culture Wars. Thank you so much for listening to us. Reminder, we do have the Patreon /VCW pod if you want to support the show. And you can give us a rating and a review wherever you like to get podcasts. And hey, if you could share an episode on your social media feeds, that would be amazing as well. You can find us on Twitter. I am at Dave J. Lester. Zach is at Muzak, M-U-Z-A-C-H. And you can go to Zach's website, muzak.bandcamp.com, and hear his music by a vinyl record. You can listen to me on an actual second podcast called Does the Bible Say That, where I go through what the Bible says, what it means, and kind of talk about all of that if you are interested wherever fine podcasts are sold.
Thanks again for coming on down to the VCW. And remember, as always, the podcast is free, but you still need to tithe 10%.